Read a moment ago in Luke chapter 7, and the other is going to be in two chapters called 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. By the way, I'm not Andy. Your loss. A few years ago, I dedicated the entire year to preaching on the subject of grace. It was a powerful year for me. If you don't obviously preach or teach publicly and having to get lessons up and having to study, you don't dig in quite as deeply. Most of us don't anyway. But that particular year, what I tried to do was just read my entire Bible over at least once, if not twice, and look for every reference I can find on God's grace in my life, what God has done for mankind and all of us. And it was an eye-opening experience for me. And ever since then, I can't read my Bible without looking for that theme all the way through. When I was a child, I learned the song, Trust and Obey. And that was kind of the way that I grew up thinking of Christianity. Certainly walking by faith, by trust, and obeying what God says. But sometimes the motivation to obey was out of, I better do this. Sort of like a child does with his parent. You just obey because if you don't, you're in trouble. And we kind of grew up thinking that way, and then when we obey the gospel, sometimes it's in how I obeyed the gospel. I was terrified of hell. It wasn't motivated to go to heaven. It was motivated to stay out of hell. And so as we've grown in our faith, though, what God is desiring of us is to know Him on an intimate basis, to feel His love, to feel His grace, His gift to us, in everything that we do, everything that we see, to read our Bibles and to see the outpouring of grace and love, mercy, kindness in our lives. And then to respond to it because of that, not just to trust and obey, but to receive and obey, to receive the grace that God has showered upon me and to want to give back to God for all that He's given to me. And it's always going to be that transition in our lives. When we're children, that's just the way it is with our parents. We're going to obey them because we fear them in some respects. But as we grow older, of course, then we want to do for our parents because we love them. And that's the way God built us, to teach and to start with the idea of response by obedience because that's required of us. It's our duty to do. But then to graduate to that, to get to a higher level of obedience because of a want to, not a have to. When we think about that idea, you think about a child, you stick a plate of broccoli or of vegetables in front of the child. And I know how I was when broccoli and spinach and other things like that were given to me. I did not want to eat it. And my mom would say, you're going to sit there until you do. And you know, my question was always, do I have to? And you understand, that's how children are. But I'll tell you what, you go to other countries of the world, and sometimes even in this country and some of the lower income places, and one out of five children today, even in America, will go to bed hungry. That's a pretty amazing statistic, living in this land of plenty. But around the world, it's certainly that way. When we think of the idea of a child receiving food, they're not going to ask, this child would not ask, do I have to eat this food you give me? Because they're so hungry, they're willing to eat just about anything you give, and gratefully so. When we think about our response to God, it should be, we're hungering and thirsting for righteousness. That's one of the Beatitudes. Blessed are those, happy are those, who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. I think about the idea if you're going to ask someone to marry you, and you're going to get on your knees, and you're going to ask, will you be my wife? Will you marry me? I saw this cartoon, and I've kept it, and it's kind of cute, when she responds and says, well, for how long? Now, how do you think that response is going to be? Or what if she said, do I have to? What kind of a response do you think he would feel, or attitude do you think he would have if she responds, how long am I going to have to be married to you? Do I have to marry you? That's not the response that a guy wants when he sits down. what he wants when he wants this is he says, "Why, yes, I want to marry you. I'm looking forward to being your wife. I want to be in your life." Well, that's the kind of response that we want. I want to do this, not that I have to do this. And that's the graduation process that we all feel as Christians as we're studying our Bibles. We want to, when we think we go to our assemblies, some people are like this sometimes. They're out there in the audience, and after I'm preaching, they're agreeing with me. You know, they're sitting there giving me their approval all the way through. They cure their insomnia for the next 30 minutes. But that's not, of course, when we think about assembling before the eyes of God, coming into His presence. After all that God has done for us, after all that God has showered upon us, as He said in the book of Malachi, "Ask me if I will not open the windows of heaven and pour out blessings that you can't even number." And to feel the goodness and the love, yes, to feel the gift that is the grace of God in our lives. When we think about whether it's an assembly or whether it's God asking us to go out and evangelize, to reach and to teach the lost, and we sometimes would ask the question, do I have to? Well, if you have felt the salvation of God as we've taken the Lord's Supper, the natural response would be, as we continue to grow in our faith, is we want to share what God has given to us. We've been saved in order to save. That's our whole world now. It is thinking always about souls, our souls, the family, our souls, the souls of our family, the souls of our neighbors and our friends. All we want to do is give back to God all that He's given to us. But I want to give one this morning I want you to think about with me, and that is giving. That's really what our lesson is this morning. And yes, we're even talking about fiscally, not physically, but fiscally, money, monetarily. Thinking about what are we giving to God. It becomes so easy, particularly in my life, when I sit down at the first of the year, I write checks out for the whole year. Because I know what my salary is, and I know how much I want to give to God. And so it becomes almost a rote thing if I'm not careful, and that's what it has become sometimes in my life. And then one of the reasons I'm preaching this lesson, and I wrote on it all this past week in my articles that I was sending out, is the idea of God's grace and all that God has given to me. Don't respond by just simply a trust and obey. I'm just going to give back to God, and sometimes you just give it out of habit without thinking, what am I giving back? What is God looking for from my heart? I don't want to just be giving a check to God. I don't want to just be putting money in a plate. What I want to be doing is I want to be responding to all the grace that God has showered upon me this week. And what can I give? What must I give? Yes. But what can I want to give back to God? That's what we're going to talk about now. It's not do I have to, but do I want to? Think about this for a passage just to start with. There's two that I've given that I want you just to give consideration to when you think of the word grace. In 1 John 4 and verse 19, we love Him because why? He first loved us. Always think that way. God is always the initiator of grace, love, and mercy. God is always, you never give first to God. God, you can't do that. God has always beat you to the punch. God is always opening the windows of heaven and blessing me. In the passage in Romans 5, we often use in the story of the Lord's when we give the talk about the Lord's Supper, but God demonstrates His own love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We were lost. We were sinners. God took the initiative. He gave first, and He gave the best that He had. He could have given the angels to give, to die for us, and that wouldn't have done much. But He gave His only begotten Son, and because He did that, for God so loved the world that He what? That He gave. And that's what we need to be thinking about. Grace, that is love, motivates. When we talk about our giving, our assembling, going out and teaching the lost, what have you, always think about God and His grace in your life. I want to start by looking at a passage in Acts chapter 16. In Acts chapter 16, Paul is on his second missionary journey, and he comes to the area of Troas, and you can see it on the map. I've got it outlined here. When you got Troas over here on this side of the on the east side of the Aegean Sea, the gospel, as far as we know, had not crossed over into Europe. Europe would be as you go up to Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea. And Paul was in Troas, and he had a vision. And there was a man in his vision that said, and this is the dream that Paul had, the vision that he had, there's a man standing saying, come over into Macedonia and help us. Who was that man? Well, that man was all the people that he's going to reach. There were the people over in Europe that were crying out for something in their life. They probably didn't even know what they were crying out for. They were looking for happiness, joy, peace, what everybody's looking for, and they didn't know where to find it. God was sending these apostles to tell the world good news. There is an answer to your problem. There's a solution. And so Paul has this vision, and he says, come over into Macedonia. Macedonia was an entire region of areas, lots of cities in this region. There's a, up in the Macedonia, and the Achaia would be down below where there was Athens and Corinth. And in this Macedonian region, Macedon was where the idea where Alexander the Great, in fact, came. Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great, founded Philippi. And so in this region, which 300 years before had this mighty empire called the Macedonian Empire or the Greek Empire, now they were in desperate straits. In fact, the entire region of Macedonia had suffered terribly. We know in the Bible how it says they were in deep poverty. They were very poor people up in this region. They had been in the course of Rome. Rome turned against them in a lot of ways, and a lot of commerce did not come into the Macedonian region. These were very poor people up here. And so they were just living hand to mouth, going through the motions, as it were, as far as life is concerned. And all of a sudden, they're looking for something in life, some kind of happiness, some kind of joy. And God gives Paul this vision to say, come over into Macedonia and help us. Well, he comes. He leaves. He crosses over the Aegean Sea. He comes up into the Philippi area. And lo and behold, we're not going to read all of the text here, but I want you to know as you study the scriptures of the people, who was that man that said, come over and help us. Lo and behold, the first person that Paul gets to when he gets to Philippi, he goes to the synagogue. There's nobody there, and so there's no synagogue, it seems, to talk to. And so he goes out to a riverside. And this riverside, there's some women that were gathered to pray. And Paul just starts talking to these women. And of these women that were gathered for prayer, there was a woman who was a seller of purple from Thyatira named Lydia. And he starts talking about the gospel, and this woman responds to that, and she obeys the gospel. She's the first European convert that we have record of. And she's baptized. And now all of a sudden, there's going to be a gathering, and her family is baptized. And now there's going to be a gathering of Christians in the city of Philippi. Well, then Paul goes out, and he starts working, and he sees this girl who's a demonic, and she is doing her thing as what the demons had it, and he cast out this demon. And I'm guessing, because stories like Legion, remember when Jesus cast Legion out, and then he became a follower, a disciple of Jesus Christ? I'm guessing maybe she became one. We're not told that, but I'm guessing maybe she did. Maybe she was part of the church in Philippi. I want you to stay with me on this. And then, because he did that, the authorities didn't like, because he took away their income. They started beating him, putting him in prison, and while he's in prison, he and Silas began praying and singing songs. The jailer, maybe who's the one who beat them, I'm not sure, but he hears them, and there's an earthquake. He thinks they've escaped. He pulls the sword, about to kill himself, and he cries out, "Don't hurt yourself, we're here." He comes in with a light, he brings them out, and we ask the $64,000 question. Do you know what it was? What must I do to be saved? He had seen something in their demeanor, in their life, in their religious fervor that he wanted that he did not have. And he became a Christian, his family became a Christian, and now all of a sudden you got Lydia and her family, maybe the demonic woman who's been healed, and now we certainly know the jailer and his family. And then later we can go down and we can see, as he writes the Philippian letter just a few years later, there's bishops and there's deacons and there's saints. In other words, the church just starts growing and growing and growing. And Paul, looking back as we look through all the different epistles that he wrote to all the different churches, it was the church in Philippi that seems to be the one that had the bond of fellowship that was closer than any other. He had grown deeply in love with these brethren, and they had grown deeply in love with him. And now, something's going to come up. He leaves Philippi, and he goes down a few miles, about 30 miles, to Thessalonica. And in Thessalonica, he finds some Jews that were there, a few of them. And then there were some Greeks. In fact, there were many Greeks and some leading women or some prominent women, as the scripture says. And they became believers. And so Thessalonica now forms its congregation. And from that, then there's a man we know his name is Jason, because when the eruption broke out, when they were trying to find Paul to bring him in and beat him up, they couldn't find him. So they grabbed Jason, they bring him in. And so he's going to be suffering. So we know that there's a man here named Jason in the church. And they hustled Paul out of town. He goes down to Berea. And in Berea, he finds some people in the synagogue. The Jews up in Thessalonica wouldn't listen to Paul. The Greeks did, but the Jews wouldn't. And he comes down there, and he comes into the synagogue, and these Jews do listen to him. And it says many of them did. And they were more noble than those in Thessalonica. They searched the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. And so these Jews become Christians. And then it says many Greeks became, and then also many leading women. So he's getting man, woman, and child here. They're all coming into the church. And so all through this region, come over into Macedonia and help us. And he comes, and in Philippi, in Thessalonica, in Berea, he's finding people to obey the gospel. They're happy today. They're happy today. In Jesus Christ, they're happy today. They have felt the grace of God. Would you take your Bible over to 2 Corinthians chapter 8? We're going to read the entire chapter together. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, as I read it, I want you to get your highlighter out, if you have one, a pencil, pen, or if nothing else, you can prick your finger and do it in blood. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, I want you to find the words grace or their equivalent in this reading. The subject is there is a famine that has hit Jerusalem, and the Jewish brethren down in Jerusalem, Acts chapter 11, verse 27 through 30 is the story here. There's a great problem in the church down there, and so Paul is taking up a collection to take it back to the Jews down in Jerusalem. They get wind of this. Now, some of these are Jews, some of these are Greeks. They get wind of this, and Paul is just kind of going to pass them by. You get this out of the book of Philippians. He's just kind of pass them by because he knows they're poverty-stricken. But down in Corinth and Athens and places that are more prominent, that are more affluent, they would be more receptive probably to giving and have more to give. But the Philippian brethren get wind of this. They have just felt the grace of God in him sending Paul to come over into Macedonia and help them. They're so ecstatic with joy of God's salvation that when they get wind that there's needy brethren, they don't even know their names, they don't even know who they are. They're so far away, they're in another world as far as they're concerned. And they said, Paul, you're not passing us by. We want to help those people. Look at all that God's done for us, we want to give to them. Read the story in chapter 8. Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia. He's writing to the Corinthians now. That in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. For I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing. You see grace in all of these verses? Imploring us with much urgency that we should receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. And not only as we had hoped, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. So we urged Titus that as he had begun, so he would also complete this grace in you as well. But as you abound in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in diligence, in your love for us, see that you abound in this grace also. I speak not by commandment, but I am testing the sincerity of your love by the diligence of others. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you, through his poverty, might be rich. And in this I give advice. It is to your advantage not only to be doing what you began and were desiring to do a year ago, but now you also must complete the doing of it, that as there was a readiness to desire it, so there will also be a completion out of it, of what you have. For if there's first a willing mind, It is accepted according to what one has, not according to what he does not have. For I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack, and their abundance also may supply your lack, that there may be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much had nothing left over, he who gathered little had no lack. But thanks be to God who puts us the same earnest care for you into the heart of Titus. For he not only accepted the exhortation, but being more diligent, he went to you of his own accord, as we have sent with him the brother whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches. And not only that, but who is also chosen by the churches to travel with us with this gift, which is administered by us to the glory of the Lord himself and to show your ready mind, avoiding this that anyone should blame us in this lavish gift which is administered by us, providing honorable things not only in the sight of the Lord but also in the sight of men. And we have sent with them our brother, whom we have often proved diligent in many things, but now much more diligent because of the great confidence which he have in you. If anyone inquires about Titus, he is my partner and my fellow worker concerning you. Or if our brethren are inquired about, they are messengers of the churches, the glory of Christ. Therefore, show to them and before the churches the proof of your love and of your boasting on our behalf. Did you ever see the word money in any of that reading? Did you see the word money there? Not there. But it's on almost every verse. Money was the topic. And he's talking about their giving. Now that you know the question, let's read chapter 9. Now concerning the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you, for I know that your willingness, about which I boast to you in the Macedonians, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal has stirred up the majority. Yet I have sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain in this respect, that, as I said, you may be ready. Lest if some Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to mention you, should be ashamed of this confident boasting. Therefore I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren to go to you ahead of time and prepare your generous gift beforehand, which you had previously promised, that it may be ready as a matter of generosity and not as a grudging obligation. But this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. He who sows bountifully will reap bountifully. So let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity. God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. As it is written, he has dispersed abroad, he's given to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. Now may he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food supply and multiply the seed you have sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness. While you are enriched in everything for all liberality, which causes thanksgiving through us to God. For the administration of his service not only supplies the needs of the saints, but also is abounding through many thanksgivings to God. While through the proof of this ministry, they glorify God for the abundance, for the obedience of their confession to the gospel of Christ, and for your liberal sharing with them and with all men. And by their prayer for you, who long for you because of the exceeding grace of God in you, thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. I know that was a long reading, but it's a necessary reading. I need that passage to think about when it comes to not just my assembling or my trying to evangelize the lost. I need that passage that helps me to understand in my giving. I don't know your heart. I don't know what you give. But I want you to think about this. God does. He knows your heart and he knows what you give. You know now the heart of God and you know what he gives and what he has given. And what he's saying is grace received leads to grace given. When you link in this passage and look at all those phrases, you find the grace, 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 grace. But then you double down on that and you look through it again and you can see passages that really explain grace. And what Paul was telling these Corinthians and these Athenians and so forth, the Corinthians down in Achaia, he says, you who have been abundantly blessed, you have all this prosperity. Rome has smiled upon Corinth. Rome has smiled upon Athens. But up here in this region of Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea, not so much. And so they're in poverty, but I want you to know something. They have shamed you. They're outgiving you. It's like when Jesus saw the woman who was the widow's mite, as it were, and all the Pharisees had thrown in all their big piles of money, and this woman throws in basically 1/18 of a penny. That's what two mites was worth. And he says, she has put in more than them all. You total all theirs up, she gave more because she gave from her heart. She gave from her lack, and they gave from their abundance. They could easily afford to give what they did and not even miss it. She gave everything, all that she had, he said. That's exactly what the Macedonians have done. They begged Paul to get involved in this giving process. They wanted to be able to help their brethren there. Even in their deep poverty, they gave abundantly. And God used Paul to say, you brethren down in Corinth, shame on you. You started a year ago, and yet you've kind of slacked off on this. You made big boast that you were going to do this, but you haven't done it. Don't shame me when I come down to you, and I bring some of these Macedonians with me, and they're going to look at you and going to say, they didn't give hardly anything. When it comes to what we're talking about, and it comes to our giving, think about passages that God gives to us. I just got a couple here. In Matthew 7, verse 11, in the Sermon on the Mount, if you then being evil, talking about fathers giving to their sons, he says, in comparison to God, you give evil to your son compared to what God gives to you. Because it says, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? God is looking from heaven and he says, he's not even a shadow cast by turning. That's what James 1 tells. Every good and perfect gift comes from above, he said, and comes down from the Father of lights with whom there's no variation or shadow cast by turning. God is always high noon when it comes to giving. He's always perfect in his gift in everything that he does. And you can't begin a day and end a day without thinking back to all the gifts that God showered upon you, from the sunshine, from the food you ate, from the air you breathed, from the people that are around you that you love. Those are all gifts from God. God gives and gives and gives. That's all that he does. And I want us to think that way when it comes to our writing a check out to give to God. Stop and don't just write a check out or give money to God when a basket is passed or left in the back. What I want you to do is I want you to count your many blessings, name them one by one, and to see what God has done, and then give. Even if it's the same amount of money, it's okay. If you give liberally, you give from your heart, you give cheerfully, that's all God's looking for. We need to think about those things. Without spending a lot of time because we're running out of time, it's already been read to us by Robbie a few moments ago in Luke chapter 7. Think about that story. I've already told it a little bit with the kids' class. This Pharisee named Simon invited the Lord into his house. And he comes in and they sit down and I'm sure he's snapping his fingers for the servants to all come and start feeding him. And he's not doing anything except sitting at Jesus' side and talking to him, conversing, excited that the Messiah is in his room. But all of a sudden here comes the door flies open and here comes this woman in. And she's got this alabaster flask and she breaks it open, very expensive, and she starts pouring it on his head and his feet. And she starts cleaning his dirty feet. And Simon is sitting there just aghast by that. What are you doing? And I'm sure he wants to stop her, but Jesus is kind of in charge, and so he lets him kind of get away with this. And then he says, if he really knew who she was, he wouldn't let this woman touch him and defile him. And he turns and he says, Simon, you see this woman? Well, dude, everybody can see the woman, but you know that he never did. He saw the woman, but he didn't see the woman. He saw Jesus, but he didn't see Jesus. He didn't see Jesus for what he really was, and he didn't see this woman for what she really was in the eyes of God. Jesus is looking at her and looking at all of that, and he's already done something. We read that text, and often I want you to think about it. In that text, it often looks like she comes in, and she does this, and she wipes his feet, and she cleans him, and she pours this out on him, and then it says, and then he forgives her. That's not what I think the text is saying. Go back and read the text carefully. In Luke chapter 7, this text is showing that she has already been forgiven, and these are tears of joy that she has come to say thank you for what you've done for me. I believe that's what the text is saying, and I think some of the translations will bear that out. When it says, her sins which are many are forgiven, For she loved much, but to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. Look at what some other translations say there. In the Holman Christian Bible, it says, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven. The Greek says it's a past tense thing. She's already been forgiven. It wasn't that he just forgave her now. It's that she has felt forgiveness. Somewhere outside that house, he had met her and forgiven her of her sins, whether it was the woman taken in adultery or whatever it might have been. This woman has been forgiven, and she wants to do something, so she runs home. She gets this alabaster flask. She knows he's in this Pharisee's house. She runs in anyway, uninvited. She breaks it. She pours it out on him. She does everything she can with tears flowing out of her eyes, washing his feet with her tears, drying them with her hair. She has felt God's forgiveness. Christ has forgiven her. In the NIV, I tell you, her sins have been forgiven. And then he says, as her great love has shown, but whoever has been forgiven little loves little. She is loving him because he first loved her. He first forgave her, and now because she's felt this massive weight of sin lifted from her and felt the love of Jesus Christ in her life, now she's responding to that. Grace received leads to grace given. She's received it, and now she's giving it back. I want you to think with me as we close our lesson this morning. The Macedonians loved much. Theirs was an attitude we want to. Paul was just going to pass them by, and they said, no, Paul, you can't do that. We want to be involved in this. Look at all that God has done for us. They sat and counted all their blessings. When they cried out, come over into Macedonia and help us, Paul came and brought them God's love and His grace and His forgiveness. And now this church that was made up of Lydia and made up of this jailer and maybe this demonic woman and their families, and then they also now have elders and deacons and other saints. This church, just when they gather together, can you imagine the love that was felt in that? They were poor, but can you imagine the love that they felt for one another? And they got wind that brothers and sisters in Christ in other parts of the world, in fact, way back over there in a far-off land, because over there is where the church began and they want to be a part of that heritage, they want to give to that work. They wanted to. Whereas the Corinthians were basically like the little boy with broccoli in front of him. Do I have to? And Paul is shaming them for that. And so the question that we think about as we think about in our own congregation here, not in Philippi or Corinth, but in the Northwest Church here, we ask the question, we've been loved much. And we've been loved much. Grace received leads to grace given. When it comes to our giving, I want you to be thinking about that. I haven't preached a sermon on giving in several years. And we don't sit here and think about statistics and money, monetary amounts, and you got to give this much, a tithe or whatever it is. The Bible doesn't teach that. As we've already read in the passages in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, God loves a what? A cheerful giver. Why is that? It's because God's a cheerful giver. Grace received leads to grace given. What that woman did in that house of the Simon the Pharisee is what we do each and every week. And I hope and pray, and I've preached this lesson, I developed this lesson for my own heart because I'd got to the point where it was mainly me giving out of rote, me giving out of just an obligation, me giving out of, and I don't want to do that. I want to count God's blessings. And I want to remember everything that God has done from week to week to week, from day to day to day. And then whenever we give to God, we give out of a cheerfulness, our liberality, our love for God. For the grace He showered upon us, we give back to Him. So we don't want to be a have-to kind of people, but a want-to kind of people. Michael's got a lesson, a song that we want to sing. I love this song. He was teaching it to us before we were singing this song before all this COVID stuff hit. And so hopefully some of you can remember the way that it's sung here. And so I want you to think about the idea of just as I am.